the recording unit had not arrived. Now, I should explain here that, of course, this was long, long before portable recording, let alone transistors. And mobile radio recording it involved the same kind of hardware on a smaller scale that television outside broadcast recording does. That is to say, a wagon with the equipment built into it, you see. In our case, it was a Ford V8 van. Oh, some will remember what the V8 was. And the first of these, which had been commissioned, had not yet arrived. But Seamus and I were sent off on a fact-finding trip, program research. And our then boss, Roberto Farrakhan, who was the head of program, as it were, in radio. He was called controller of radio programs later. He was called then deputy director. Along with Lone O'Brien and one or two others, who really transformed radio in the late 40s, and who fought hard for facilities and so on. And this idea of opening up the countryside was, I think, basically his. Now, he wanted to send us, he wanted, as it were, to do the least obvious thing at the beginning. And he decided to send us to a county, the county, as he said, least in the news. And he decided on Leitrim. So we went to County Leitrim. And that was in September 47. And there we talked to all sorts and conditions of people. And we listened to all sorts and conditions of music. And we got up to all sorts and conditions of adventures, but we didn't do any recording on that occasion.
We called the program Leitrim of the Lakes or Land of the Lakes or something like that, because there had been some offensive article, Land of Mud and Rushes, about Leitrim, which was highly objectionable to some people at the time. And our job was to explore Leitrim and see what we'd find in it. We did quite a lot on the economical life in the different parts of Leitrim, and I did some Leitrim fiddle playing and some Leitrim singing, and more or less a rather colourful programme.
What's this, Joe?
Oh, I don't know. What is it?
Was something wrong?
Customs examination. What carriage is it?
Customs examination?
Yes.
You know this in the customs station?
It is, yes.
Oh, I'm on the wrong road, though.
Seamus Ennis's great expertise was, of course, as a collector of traditional music. He did this for the Irish Folklore Commission, for Radio Éireann, and for the BBC. It's probably true to say that nobody else could have done it so well. He had the empathy, the knowledge, and an open mind to appreciate the different styles of traditional music in different parts of the country. Had he not done it, much of this music might well have died when those who had learned it from their own parents died. He collected many songs from Elizabeth Cronin of Ballyvourna.
I can remember frequently visiting her. And one afternoon I went out to visit her to write more songs for her. She had a sheaf of songs written for me. And I told her she shouldn't be putting herself in the trouble. And she said she'd rather be chatting with me than dictating songs to me. And I can remember the first song that I ever heard her sing was in the form of a lullaby. It was a kind of lullaby thing based on the Christ Child lullaby, The Jealousy of St. Joseph, and that's a long story, we won't go into it. But that was the first one I ever wrote from her. And I remember another one. She was a jolly lady too. cold potatoes, cold potatoes, salt, and dip it in salt, and dip it in cold potatoes, salt, and dip it in food for the king. She'd be singing little things like that going on about her household duties.
Seamus Ennis was also the first to record Willie Clancy. Seamus Ennis left Ratty Warren in 1951. He was recruited by Brian George of the BBC to collect traditional music throughout Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England, and to contribute to a very popular BBC radio programme of the time, As I Roved Out.
Seamus Ennis is a tall, good-looking Irishman who spins a fine tale, sings many a song, plays the tin whistle, jigs with the fiddle, and is one of the finest exponents of the Irish pipes. He has noted down folk tunes for the Irish Folklore Commission, and spent 5 busy years combing the British Isles with a tape recorder for the BBC. Well, this evening we're going to get some idea of his great versatility as a performer as he takes a look at one of the early Irish folk song collections.
At this time, Seamus Ennis was living in London. His marriage didn't last, and he returned to Ireland to work as a freelance. In Peter Brown's documentary series, The Seamus Ennis Story, his 2 children, Catherine and Christopher, tell of how they were reunited many years later with their father when they were adults.
You have to remember the whole story of our family, which is that we were born in London.
When Seamus was working for the BBC.
And when I was 6 1/2 or 6 3/4, stamped on my memory, and herself was a little younger, our parents separated. And he went back to Ireland. We stayed over there, and we didn't see him for a long time. But during those early years, I did a fair bit of travelling with him, and I stayed in Finglas and met his parents. And I've got differing memories of both of them. His father taking me down the fields for a cack. can't repeat that, can you? And with the shovel. And my grandmother, who was very fierce, I was terrified of her, absolutely terrified of her. She used to breed Alsatians, and she was a big woman. And, well, maybe she wasn't, but I remember as a big woman. She bred Alsatians, she was very fierce, and she used to shout at me to eat my breakfast all the time, and I was terrified of going there.
And my mother was working, well, she was an air stewardess. She was working in Africa and all sorts of places. Married Seamus after a bout of malaria. And we lived
Scotland
in...
Scotland says, well, the balance of her mind was disturbed.
we can understand why she did it. But anyway, we lived in London. And then when Seamus came back to Ireland, we stayed in London. And we were born and reared there. So the first time I came to Ireland in my living memory was when I was 19, when I was an undergraduate at Oxford. I met my father while I was there. And it was a wonderful trip. We went over to stay in Milton Malby. Maisie O'Friel, and that was a real experience that's stamped on my memory very strongly.
And every time I used to come across, we'd go to the Willie Clancy flower at Milltown and stay at Maisie's, and that was the highlight of the tour. Whenever was a late riser anyway, because his work in broadcasting. It was a late start. And then planning for the day ahead.
Oh, yes. That evening, it was very important, meeting people in the pub. Yeah.
Well, in all those intervening years, then, was there any contact between ye and him?
Well, no, not at all. Except that once he wrote a letter to... Because we'd moved house, he couldn't contact us directly. But once he'd moved... he wrote to my grandmother in Liverpool, and she passed the letter on to us. And I remember being very excited about that. Do you remember that time, Chris? When I was about 14, and I wrote him a long letter. We were both at boarding school. My mother had sent him our addresses. And I wrote him a long letter and never heard anything back. And when we were looking through his papers, this Christmas, we got round to it because we were so upset after his death, we put it off. I found the letter that he'd written in answer to me then, and he'd never sent. I don't know why. It was a lovely letter. Any child would have been thrilled to receive, full of the sort of typical word games that Seamus was so good at. A very loving letter, and we didn't... I never received it, and we never knew.
He did make another attempt, of course, which when we finally did...
He was ill then. He realised it was a sort of last-ditch attempt. He'd had a crash, and he was very, very low.
Yeah.
And he finally got in touch with us. And we received a phone number, and we cast lots as to which one of us should make the telephone call. And the lot fell on me. And I rang up, and I said, "Hello, can I speak to Seamus Ennis?" And he said, "That's me." And I said, "Oh, hello." Very difficult. I said, "This is your daughter. Remember me? I was the one, you know, who was four with the short hair." And it was very difficult to know what to say, but he was wonderful. He said, "I have a big lump in my throat, Catherine, and it's lovely to hear you." And oh, it was all right from then on, really.
Catherine and Christopher talked to Peter Brown about visits to County Clare with their father.
You were saying that you did a tape once with him.
Seamus and I sang together in Milltown once, and there was an American girl recording it, and she played it back, and it was the first time I'd ever heard myself singing on tape. And it was astonishing because it did sound very much like we were double-tracking and singing a couple of funny old things that he taught me then.
He was very proud of you, wasn't he, then?
He said so. But I think it was a source of disappointment that I didn't learn to play the pipes. Disappointment to me as well, I might say. But as he always said, it was 7 years learning, 7 years practicing, and 7 years playing before you could say you could actually play the pipes.
If that was a disappointment, it was a source of pride to Seamus Ennis that his daughter Catherine was a classical organist. She recalled her last meeting with him.
I saw him the summer before he died, in August. He died in October, and I was over in August. And the last thing he said to me was he handed me a tape of The Lament for the Fox and said, "Play this on the organ." And I said, "No, it won't work. And after he died, I was doing a lot of travelling at that time and a lot of driving, and I played this tape over and over again in the car because I was so devastated by his loss. I don't know why it was, but I was my life went to pieces for 6 months after he died. It was extraordinary. And I listened to this an awful lot, and I began to play it, and I began to see that, yes, it could work. There could be a possibility for my instrument to play my father's music. And that was a wonderful sort of consolation. In fact, the year afterwards, I came to play in Dunleary, and I played The Lament for the Fox on the organ. And I enjoyed it. I don't know what everybody else thought, but it was very beautiful for me to play it. And that's, in a sense, why it's lovely to be able to play with Liam, to play some of Seamus's melodies.
Tonight.
We'll be playing it tonight, yeah. Mm-hmm. To play some of Seamus's favourite tunes, and for me to get involved in it. Something more evocative and more real about the music than about the sort of memories we've been talking about. For me, it's a lot more moving, a lot more important.
Best time to stumble through it on the whistle.
Oh, no, you can sing it beautifully and you can play it well. But so that was really... I had a time out here in that summer, and I spent a few days with him, and I discovered that he was ill, and he wouldn't admit to me that he was ill. Out of a misguided sense of chivalry, he didn't want me to suffer, that he was suffering.
We first heard, in fact, when we were discussing which day we were arriving, and he just had a telephone installed, which was great, because always before we'd have to ring the farm and sort of wait a couple of hours.
Do you know what happened? We were waiting at the airport for him to come over.
Well, that was the other thing. He was coming over for John Cage's thing in London, and Catherine and I were waiting at the airport all day, and he didn't come on any of the planes.
We rang up the farm and said, "Where is he?" And they said, "Oh, did you not know he has a telephone now?" So he rang up.
Well, I rang up that evening. Were you there?
I rang up. We both rang up. And there was somebody who couldn't talk at the other end. He'd had a terrible throat He had throat cancer, and he had had radium treatment, and he couldn't speak, and he was making clacking sounds as if he had no tongue. And
he'd been on chemotherapy for a long, long time, it turned out, but he'd not let on to us. And
for a man,
we noticed that that his bedroom was like an apothecary's shop for years, but we put that down to hypochondria. And on the phone, anyway, he admitted to me, and he said, I don't want Catherine to know this, but I've had radiotherapy. I have cancer." And I sort of shocked, you know, Bateman cartoon the other end. And he then said to me, "But I tell you this, Chris, I absolutely refuse to die. I absolutely and steadfastly refuse to die."
That time he didn't turn up and I spoke to him on the phone and he couldn't talk.
Mm.
I felt this is just terrible for a man of the verbal abilities of Seamus not to be able to communicate verbally. Was the worst possible way for him to go. And that was cruel. It was like Beethoven being deaf, and it was the same sort of, wild allegory, but it's the same sort of thing.
And when he died, just 20 years ago, Sean McRaymond paid this tribute to his lifelong friend in a programme of tribute presented by Kieran McMahona.
I learned a lot from Seamus Ennis when we started exploring Ireland for radio in the late 40s. I learned a lot from him about traditional music, of course, and here may I make a public confession that I hadn't much taste for it until then. It was Seamus who first made me listen to the real hard stuff, you know, not to the dressed-up stuff. And like all converts, I became a bit fanatical afterwards. But I learned much more, of course. I learned a lot about Ireland from him, a lot about the Ireland that he knew and that I didn't know so well. Of course, he was fantastic. He, as Sean McConaughey said earlier on, when he learned a song, he made it his own, but he retained with an extraordinary integrity the particular duchess from which he had got it. And he seemed to belong to the song and the song to him. He was a great piper. I don't have to be more qualified than me can say that. He was a great singer. He sang the songs. But best of all, he was a communicator. He could communicate to me and to everybody the delight that he personally took in the songs and in the tradition that he came from. So, drink his peace. Good this grey juice of the barley runs with a light that ever pleased his eye. Benach Dile Nan.
Amen.
This morning's programme was based on original programmes by Harry Bradshaw, Peter Brown, Kieran McMahona, Porrick O'Rahilly, Julian Binyells, and Seamus Ennis himself. More voices from the archives at the same time on Saturday morning next. Thank you for listening, and good morning.
Presented and produced by John Bowman.